What's up, Pharmacy Nation? Thank you for listening to the Elective Rotation, a critical care hospital pharmacy podcast. I'm your host, Pharmacy Joe. This is episode 3, and we will be discussing pharmacist involvement on rapid response teams. According to Wikipedia, please don't tell my professors I reference Wikipedia, a rapid response team is a team of healthcare providers that responds to a hospitalized patient with early signs of clinical deterioration on non-intensive care units to prevent respiratory or cardiac arrest. The idea behind these teams is that if you can identify a patient with an early sign of deterioration before they code, then you can either stabilize them or transport them to the ICU where they have a much better chance of surviving the code. Who can activate one of these rapid response calls? At my hospital, it's anyone, but it's usually the bedside nurse who makes this call. Who's on the team? We have a critical care nurse that responds, respiratory therapy responds, a hospitalist and pharmacist will respond. There are plenty of false alarms, and you really need to accept that you will get some calls that turn out not to be necessary. That's okay. The team should never say anything negative if they determine there was no need for a rapid response. This could lead to that same person, that same bedside nurse, avoiding calling in the future when they might actually need to get help for their patient. And this same principle is actually used with STEMI care. And cardiology cath lab teams, they accept a certain percentage of the time the ED is going to call them in to do a cath on a patient, and it turns out it wasn't a STEMI on the EKG. Really, the patient just sprained their pinky or something like that, and they go home and they tuck themselves back in bed and they don't get upset over it. And you want to make sure that you're doing the same whenever you're on a rapid response team. Now, notification at my hospital comes by beeper only. That's as opposed to codes, which are by page overhead and then beeper. To reach the room or area of the rapid response, take the stairs whenever possible, just like a code. Identify yourself to the staff already in attendance. Take a moment to observe the patient and the care being administered, just like in a code. Is BiPAP being placed on them? Did it turn into a code and now someone's doing chest compressions? Is the patient sitting up? Are they now doing cartwheels down the hall? Take a look-see and find out from your own perspective what you think is going on. You're going to need to ask when you enter the room for an explanation of the situation. Everybody seems has to ask, at least that's the culture at my institution, where even the doctor comes in and nobody says a word until the doctor says, what's going on? So when you walk in, you're going to need to say the same thing, what's going on? And hopefully you'll get an explanation from the bedside nurse or someone else who was there and saw the events that resulted in the rapid response call. Now, the pharmacist's role at a rapid response is to obtain needed medications, look for medication-related causes of the patient's deterioration, assist the team however else is needed. Often that's by reading aloud recent labs and meds administered. I've already got the computer up already because I'm looking at recent meds to identify med-related causes. And so why not just shout out what the INR, the white blood cell count, or any other pertinent labs are. And then just like in a code that we talked about on previous episodes, I want to anticipate and prepare in advance for the patient's pharmacotherapy needs. Now, as far as what types of problems you are going to encounter on these rapid response calls, almost all of these problems are related to an issue with oxygen delivery. Now, sometimes the problem is even more basic than oxygen delivery. I know I'm going to bring this all the way back to the Krebs cycle here. Sometimes the problem is with ATP generation. And by that, I mean the patient's hypoglycemic. So they can have all the oxygen they need, but without any glucose, you're not going to be making any ATP. So don't forget that. But the overwhelming majority are related to oxygen delivery. So let's take a moment to review some common causes of decreased oxygen delivery. Since we're pharmacists, I've got this, what I call the nerdy pharmacist equation for oxygen delivery. And it's a linear equation, and it goes like this. You can see it visually in the show notes, but just try and visualize it here for a moment. Oxygen delivery equals your stroke volume times your heart rate times your hemoglobin times your percent oxygen saturation. That's stroke volume times heart rate times hemoglobin times oxygen saturation. And so a lowering of one or more of those is going to cause two things. It's going to cause an initial decrease in oxygen delivery, but then it's going to cause compensatory mechanisms in order to, for your body to, or the patient's body to try and increase the oxygen delivery. So the easiest way that the patient can compensate to a low stroke volume, a low hemoglobin, or low oxygen saturation is by increasing the heart rate. And so you'll see sinus tachycardia oftentimes when you have a patient that has a problem with oxygen delivery. And this is why you'll hear over and over clinicians say, don't treat sinus tach, treat the cause. And that is because if you lower the heart rate in a patient who's trying to compensate for reduced stroke volume or low hemoglobin or low oxygen saturation, then you're going to cause a cardiovascular collapse in that patient because you've wiped out the single compensatory mechanism they have in order to try and cope with whatever the underlying problem is. So don't treat sinus tach. Sinus tach is like a fever. You need to find out what the cause is. And there's a bonus nerdy equation I have here for your blood pressure. Your blood pressure is your cardiac output times your peripheral vascular resistance. And so that's something else that you can see. When the blood pressure is low, you want to think of what the underlying cause is. And the two components there, again, are cardiac output and peripheral vascular resistance. So trouble with either of those is going to cause a low blood pressure. So if we go back to oxygen delivery, let's just review conditions that lower the percent oxygen saturation. Now, these can be broken up. One category would be a functional airway obstruction, and that could be from a decreased level of consciousness where muscles relax and allow the tongue to obstruct airflow. And a very common reason for that would be a seizure. Possibly over-sedation from medications would be another cause for a functional airway obstruction. And you can do airway maneuvers to try and open up that airway, maybe antidote therapy if you believe a drug that has an antidote can be reversed, or intubation and mechanical ventilation for those patients. You could also have a mechanical airway obstruction. That could be aspiration of a foreign body, angioedema, anaphylaxis, stridor, which could be an upper or lower airway obstruction, bleeding in the airway. And so your treatment there would be anaphylaxis treatment, if that was the problem, racemic epinephrine nebs for stridor, and intubation if that appears to be needed. You can predict that it is probably going to be difficult. And so you want to take preparations for that. We will discuss that in a future podcast. And if intubation is not successful, then a surgical airway is the only other problem, or the only other possible solution for that patient. Also, remember breathing requirements. In order for the patient to breathe, they need an intact respiratory center in the brain. They need intact nervous pathways from the brain to the diaphragm and accessory muscles. They need adequate diaphragm and accessory muscle function, and they need that unobstructed flow. And so issues with any of those could cause a low oxygen saturation. Now, the respiratory rate is a very important indicator of inadequate oxygen delivery. So your lack of oxygen leads to anaerobic respiration, which leads to lactic acidosis, which leads to tachypnea or an increased respiratory rate. So you can see as a sign of inadequate oxygen delivery, tachypnea. The patient's trying to compensate in order to increase their percent oxygen in their blood. Some other possible causes could be pulmonary embolism or shunting of blood. Those could all also lower your percent oxygen saturation. So what's left in the equation? We have oxygen delivery equals oxygen saturation times hemoglobin times your cardiac output times your heart rate. So causes of low hemoglobin, blood loss, maybe from a coagulopathy, hemolysis. This could be from medications. Disseminated intravascular coagulation is another possible cause. Usually, the cause is blood loss, and it's oftentimes fairly obvious where the source is. Let's move on to causes of low cardiac output. Cardiac output is your stroke volume times your heart rate. So possible causes of low cardiac output include any decrease in stroke volume. That could be a decreased contractility. That could be an MI. That could be acidosis. That could be medications. A decreased preload, low intravascular volume, such as from blood loss or sepsis, or a high intrathoracic pressure. You can predict that this will usually happen after intubation because remember, you're doing a mechanical ventilation. You're forcing air into the intrathoracic space and you are causing a high pressure there that's not normally there. Normally, we breathe by negative pressure ventilation. So you're doing positive pressure ventilation and you can predict that there's going to be a decrease in preload from this and then therefore cardiac output is going to drop. So this is why you want to be prepared with a fluid bolus or very possibly a vasopressor if you're going to intubate someone. Moving on with causes of low cardiac output, bradycardia, a fall in systemic vascular resistance. This could be sepsis, pancreatitis, decompensated liver disease, a drug that blocks the sympathetic nervous system such as metoprolol, clonidine, something that has direct action on an arterial smooth muscle. Could be drugs, maybe propofol, and hyperthermia. So also I find it's important to look when you go to a rapid response and you see a patient with decreased cardiac output, usually they're hypotensive. You want to look for the causes of hypotension. So you have inadequate cardiac output. That leads to inadequate oxygen delivery. That leads to organ failure. That leads to lactate formation. And that leads to shock. So when someone's in shock, that's pretty obvious. Lactate formation, you can check that. You have to send a blood sample on ice to the lab, and then you get a lactate level. Might take up to an hour to get back. So it's really easy to look for organ failure and altered mental status or reduced urine output, oliguria, are two easy ways that you can look and spot organ failure without having to run any labs, do any tests, look at any machines. Just look right at the patient and look at their Foley bag or ask if they're making urine. Now, speaking of altered mental status, that's another common finding that you will have in patients when you come to their rapid response. And here are some causes for altered mental status. Could be decreased oxygen delivery. We talked about that already. Could be a decrease in blood glucose. We talked about that already. You need ATP. But it also could be from drugs. There are plenty of sedatives that can cause this. Check the patient's pupils, or if you there are too many people in the room and you can't get over to the patient's pupils, ask the nurse what the pupils look like. If the pupils are big, think sympathetic overactivity, think anticholinergic toxicity, and then look at the patient's medication profile to see if the meds match up. If the pupils are small, think opioid toxicity or cholinergic toxicity. Now, speaking of these toxicities, you want to be aware of the common toxidromes. as a pharmacist, people are going to look at you not only as the expert on how to use drugs correctly, but as the expert on what to do when something went wrong with those drugs, if the patient is toxic on them. So I'm going to leave this to the show notes because it's a little too complicated to just go over verbally. But I want you to take a look at the show notes. I'm going to put four common toxidromes there that I've adapted from the book Goldfrank's Toxicologic Emergencies, and that's going to be an anticholinergic, cholinergic, opioid, and sympathomimetic toxidromes. Now, future episodes are going to include the pharmacotherapy essentials for dealing with a lot of things that you will typically find that patients have on rapid responses: chest pain, hypotension, hypoxia, respiratory distress, seizure, stridor, tachycardia, bradycardia, the need for urgent intubation. Until we get there, I do have in the show notes some areas for self-study that I want you to take a look at. Please review the ACLS guidelines. I've linked to the Section 8 for adult ACLS guidelines there, the surviving sepsis guidelines, stroke guidelines. I put the STEMI guidelines on there, and you should review your institutional hypoglycemia protocol and your institutional code blue policy. That's it for this episode. Please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcatcher. Thank you so much for listening. I'll see you in the next episode of the Elective Rotation.